Steve Griffiths. We've got an hour of news, information and articles from the tech world. Welcome. I've joined by Jay, who's Hello. In the studio. Hi, Jay. It's a special week for you, isn't it?
It's a very special week. It's my birthday.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So, it's your birthday, Jay, yeah?
Oh, it was. It was on Tuesday, yeah.
Okay. Well, we're joined in the studio also by Darren George. Darren's from Equinox 3D Engineering. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
That's great. And we'll be talking to you in a little bit. But first, I think Jay's got a couple of news stories that relate to your birthday,
yes,
I understand.
Well, I thought that it would be, because it's so current, that actually I was born on exactly the same day as the internet.
Really?
On the 23rd of August, 1991.
I wish I could say that.
So I thought I'd start off with some interesting facts, as it was World Internet Day on my birthday. So did you know, Steve, that 40% of the world actually has access to the internet?
That's amazing, actually.
It's a lot of people.
Yeah, it is, actually, yeah.
And there are 3.4 billion internauts as of the 1st of July 2016, and half of these are on Facebook.
Internauts.
Apparently that's what you call people who use the internet.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
According to my producer, anyway.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
So, and then there are also 1 billion websites on the World Wide Web.
That's amazing. A billion.
A billion
that's
websites.
That's a lot of content, isn't it?
It's a lot of content. Yeah.
I've got a little story about ransomware, actually. Picked it up from the BBC News, actually, which is really interesting. Now, ransomware is where unwanted software is put onto a device. It then actually requests some form of payment. So it is effectively demanding a ransom. It's a growing trend, actually. And through an FOI, Freedom of Information request, it transpires that at least 21 universities have been hit by some form of ransomware. Yeah, it's a big, big issue. That none of them have paid money,
right?
Interesting enough. But those that ask for sums of money actually range, the largest amount was £2,200. Or actually 5 bitcoins.
Right.
Why you would ask for bitcoins, I have no idea. But yeah, I think what we'll do in future shows, I think we're going to have somebody coming along to talk about threat management and actually monitoring.
It's so important.
Yeah,
companies.
There's a lot of software out there that helps people to do that. And in fact, Info Security Show, which runs every year, we were there ourselves and had a look at some of the systems that are in place. And it's not only about threat management, it's about monitoring systems and actually controlling where staff go as well on your system. So yeah, really, really good. I think there's one more news story before we join our guest.
Well, this one I thought was quite interesting. So this week, a company called Newtonomy, which are a US-based startup developer, have started a trial of self-driving taxis in Singapore.
Okay. Wasn't there a film that had a self-driving taxi in it once? With Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do you remember that?
Total Recall.
Yeah, yeah.
That might be your generation.
It may be, yeah, yeah. Darren, do you remember Total Recall?
Yeah, vaguely.
Yeah, I think it was Johnny Cabs, they called it, and it was like a self-driving taxi. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, these ones are going to be quite more modern, I guess.
Right, okay.
So they've launched with 6 of them, only in a small part of the west of the city. And they're basically, because Singapore is the perfect city for it, because everything is quite nicely laid out, very well organised. So they're trying to trial them now, but they're hoping that within 2018 they're going to launch a whole fleet that will travel across all of Singapore, which is quite incredible.
Amazing,
really.
Amazing, yeah.
Currently they still have people and drivers within them, but they're not actually driving, they're just there in case anything goes wrong.
Darren, would you go in a self-driving taxi?
It's hard to know how you feel about it.
Yeah.
Because as a passenger in the car, I feel really uneasy. I'd much prefer to be driving.
Me too.
It.
Yeah.
But I did actually look at autonomous vehicles as part of my daughter's dissertation.
Oh, right.
She was looking at autonomous ambulances.
Yeah.
And there's some quite interesting sort of legal positions.
Yeah,
to think
who's driving
about,
it, who's responsible.
Driving, who's responsible.
Yeah.
In the event of an accident, what have you. It's... But it's interesting tech, I think. It's
yes,
everyone's
amazing.
Pushing
yeah,
it's for it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think you'd still have to tip?
Well, hopefully not.
No, there's no driver. There's no one to tear.
Maybe with bitcoins.
Yeah, that's five bitcoins or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our guest. So Darren George is joining us, and Darren, you're from Equinox 3D Engineering. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
And what we like to do is obviously talk about your technology and what you do.
Yeah.
But also talk a little bit about how you arrived at 3D engineering. What area were you working in before? Where did you?
Well, my background's in motorsport.
Okay.
I was in Formula One as a design engineer for nearly 10 years.
Yes.
I left and formed my own company to do essentially design and build kit cars.
All right. I mean, I've built a couple of kit cars myself, actually. Yeah, yeah. Nothing ever fitted, by the way.
I used my background in F1 to try to make cars that were not more expensive but had good engineering as their foundation.
Right.
But over time, the need to be involved in sort of high-tech design hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
But the kit car industry won't allow you to develop in that way.
No.
But various projects working with my current business partner, Dave, came up that required some pretty advanced design or design skills. And then they were fairly advanced manufacturing projects, even though they're kind of throwaway items. They were normally talking about figurines for amusement arcades and things like that. But we decided that to gain control and really push the boundaries of what was possible, we needed to develop an in-house, like a complete design to end product manufacturing system. We've been going about just over a year now.
Yeah. Based in Kent?
Near Faversham.
Near Faversham, yeah. Right. So what was the kit car industry before? What kit cars were you involved with?
First of all, started doing a Lotus 7 replica, primarily because I was building one while I was in F1, and I learned a lot of hands-on skills in F1 in order to be able to build this car.
Yeah.
And I just took that on when the team that we were working for went under.
Yeah.
I took that on and started that as a business.
Right.
Then tried, in the meantime, along with that, got dragged into doing some touring car racing and touring car development work. And that kind of sent me off in two different directions, keeping the kit cars as a product and doing design consultancy work as a...
I mean, we see a huge amount of technology in F1. I mean, it seems to change year on year. The improvement never stops. I think that's the thing you see. What technology do you think is going to come across into everyday vehicles in F1 at the moment? Where do you see that going in terms of informing everyday vehicles?
It's quite difficult for people to see the influence that F1 has on road vehicles because they don't look like a road vehicle.
Yeah.
But the FIA, who are the governing body of motorsport, they invest a lot of money using F1 technology to improve things like safety.
Yeah.
The F1 really is about efficiency.
Yes.
It's using high tech to be able to produce the most efficient vehicle.
Yeah.
The electronic systems in the cars from 30 years ago are what we're seeing in cars today.
Yeah.
They're used in slightly different ways.
Yes, of course.
You know, in F1 we're talking about engine management systems. Yeah. Now they're talking about hybrid management systems. We're seeing those in our cars coming out as, engine management, but also in the way that you interact with the car. So you can see a direct correlation with what was happening in F1 sort of 20, 30 years ago.
It's now coming across into the
mainstream. Now coming across. But I think in terms of, as we're looking towards electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, things like weight, things like friction reduction, everything that F1 is about in terms of efficiency, road car manufacturers are having to look at and learn from order to make better cars for the future.
I mean, I find it incredible that by going to the hybrid system, which was 2 years ago, I think.
Yes.
I think they changed the engines there. That now, they were really struggling at the start with fuel consumption, weren't they?
Yes.
And now they're absolutely blitzing it, I think. It's very rare that they have to go into fuel-saving strategies.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's solely about combustion efficiency, about how the hybrid links in with the petrol engine itself.
Yes.
And we're seeing a few road cars where that's coming to being as well, aren't we?
Yeah, we're having to. The environmental aspects of using a car is forcing vehicle manufacturers to be ever more efficient, make ever more efficient combustion designs. And that, you know, Formula One has gone that way because of competitiveness.
Yep.
So they've come at it from two different angles, but the end result is
it's
the same
forcing
thing.
Them to develop that technology as well. So yeah. It's great. And obviously there's a myriad of other technology in F1 around, you know, sensing and knowing what the vehicle dynamics are doing and feeding that back as well, which we're seeing in road cars as well, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Whether it's like speed-sensitive steering or the engine management process and understanding what the vehicle's doing and why.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, 10 years ago, it was unusual to have any form of traction control or stability safety systems. Well, they're commonplace now, and that came from F1 as well, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, we could talk about motorsport all day long, but it's about the technology of motorsport, I think, that we most interest us. Tell us a little bit about Equinox 3D then. What do you actually do? And you say you've been going a year, is that right?
That's right. Well, as Equinox 3D, we've been going a year. But as the sort of parent company, which is essentially a mouldings company, has been going for 20-odd years, I've been doing my design work as a freelance consultant, if you like, for the 10 years since I left F1.
Yep.
But we've come together to form this company where essentially we can design and make trick stuff.
Yep.
We have CAD design in-house.
Yeah.
Which is always the foundation for like a good product. We've got a laser scanner for essentially reverse engineering things because we're involved in creating some fairly complex shapes.
Yes.
Being able to capture something that exists and maybe modify it. Or we do a lot of work with CGI models.
Right.
Where we take...
So you take the CAD CGI or 3D model on...
3D model, say, from a movie.
Yep.
And then make...
A solid item.
Yeah, or which quite often we then take moulds from in order to produce a production run of components.
Yep.
We've got a 3D printer because that, again, allows us to make these very complex shapes easily. And we have multi-axis machining, which is... driven directly from the CAD system.
So I'm actually fascinated by 3D printing. It kind of blows my mind a bit. I still don't really understand it. All I know is that it's done by layers.
Yeah.
But could you just tell us and the audience kind of a bit more about how it works, the kind of structural way it works behind it?
Yeah. It's called 3D printing because the end result is three-dimensional.
Yeah.
But really, like a lot of things, you're breaking it down into two D componentry that you're then building on top of one another.
Right.
So you take a football, for example, the software slices it into quarter millimeter thick slices, has a look at what the two dimensional profile would be at that slice.
Yeah.
And the printer has basically got a cord of plastic that it extrudes through a hot nozzle.
Right.
It draws the 2D profile at that slice and then moves up quarter of a millimetre and does it again. So
right.
Over time you build your three-dimensional item.
Because I was reading in the news I think a couple of months ago that there's a restaurant in France that's just started to print all of their food, which amazes me. I mean,
yeah, I'm new
printed
to
gatto. I mean, what more could you want?
How does it do that?
I'm sort of new to the idea of 3D printing food, but I've seen a lot of feeds on Twitter about it.
Yeah.
And it looks fascinating. And I can't quite get my head around how they actually... We're extruding plastic is kind of easy to understand. You warm it up, squeeze it, it comes out. Quite how you do that with...
With food.
I mean,
food.
If Jay's cooking, you'll probably be pleased that there's a 3D printing.
Printed beans on toast.
<That's>, yeah.
And 3D printing is not particularly quick, so I can't imagine that food would be very hot. And
but, I mean, I'm right in saying there's been massive steps forward over the last, say, 2 to 3 years about scanning. So you've got laser scanning technology that can actually 3D model something for you.
Yes.
You can then very quickly and readily amend that model or change it in some way.
Yeah.
And then actually to get that into a printed version, I mean, you might have to run it overnight or something, I assume.
Yes.
You can then see, whether it's in scale or full size, what the actual finished product is going to be. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can take anything that you've scanned, and the scanning is incredible.
Yeah.
It's taken me by surprise because we didn't have that 10 years ago in Formula One. And it's a relatively new technology, and it is absolutely incredible.
And what's that? I assume that's saving hours and hours and hours of CAD design work.
It saves a lot of time, but also it's incredibly accurate.
Really?
If you've got something that's a very complex shape, you had next to no chance of accurately replicating it in CAD. You had to make a lot of assumptions of certain things, and essentially you might have something that looked right, but you had no way of knowing if it was dimensionally accurate.
Yeah.
These scanning systems are down to sort of 0.02 of a millimetre accurate on the entire shape of the item.
And does it use a series of lasers to scan, or is it just a single pass over?
There's various methods of doing it. Laser scanning is one of them. It's actually potentially not particularly accurate, laser scanning.
Right.
Our scanner's what they call a structured light scanner. It actually uses an HD video camera to record a series of patterns projected onto a shape, and it figures out from the way that the patterns are distorted what the shape must be that caused that distortion.
Right.
Like I say, it's very accurate. It can pick up fingerprints on your finger.
Yeah.
We've used it recently to make a dashboard for a supercar that we designed and built.
Okay.
Where we took the original dashboard, Maserati dashboard, scanned it, filled in some holes that weren't required anymore, and 3D printed it that night.
So, and what about limitations on size? Are you mainly printing to scale and then upscaling afterwards, or?
In the case of the Maserati, that was 1-to-1. Right. Because we basically wanted exactly what they had, but with a couple of holes deleted.
Yep.
For the rest of the Maserati project, we needed to scan the entire vehicle. So again, we needed it 1-to-1, but it was a large thing to scan.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But we needed that because we had to design something that interfaced with the body all over. We do figurines for amusement arcade machines. You could take we're doing Tom and Jerry at the moment.
Yep. So you could take
a small figurine, scan it and increase it to the size that you want.
Yeah. So you take the design, how does that then get into the finished product or the molded product? What's the processes after the scanning, 3D design? How does that then turn into a final item?
Well, you've got with this current business, we can stop at sort of at any point, if you like.
Yep.
So we could have the 3D printed item as the finished product.
Yep.
Quite often we use that for prototyping purposes.
Yep.
So we're printing a model at the moment, which is going to go to a studio for final approval of the design. If we're then making a production run of components, that would typically be in fiberglass or in carbon. At which point you would make a mould from that shape.
And that would be moulded out of, I assume, like a five-axis CNC?
Well, we can actually take moulds directly from the 3D print.
Oh, okay,
that's
one way to do it. Yeah.
Be the end of that particular process. Or we have a four-axis CNC machine.
Yep.
So we can carve the shape out of usually high-density foam or aluminium.
And then that's used to mould the fiber.
To make the mould, yeah.
Yeah. So is there much work around designing the mould, i.e. with things like the shut lines?
Yes.
All those. So it's not as simple as just scan, send it to the...
No, the benefit of the printer is that you can skip those steps.
Yep.
With the CNC, you've got a limitation with where you can access certain shapes. So, yes, you've got to then put some design input in to make sure that you've got your split lines in the right place or whatever.
Yeah.
We can take some shortcuts with things like fiberglass molding.
Yeah.
With carbon molding, it's just so stiff that it won't come out of molds if you haven't put split lines in the right place. So there is a lot more CAD input, if you like.
And do you see, I assume you do both fiberglass and carbon fiber molding.
Yes.
Carbon fiber molding is a little bit more complicated to actually perform, is that right?
It's a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
It's a lot more clinical, if you like.
Because it has to be vacuumed and then
for
the curing process, is that right?
It's essentially a textile of carbon filaments, pre-impregnated with resin. You put it in a mould. You then draw a vacuum on that to make sure that everything is forced in every part of the mould down hard against the mould surface. And then it requires baking in an oven.
Right.
Usually something like 5 hours at 150 degrees. And then you've got a very high strength, extremely lightweight component at the end of it.
So what's the most unusual thing?
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
So what's the most unusual thing that you've had to create or mould?
Strangely enough, although they're sort of silly items, if you like, these figurines that we do for the amusement industry, they just capture people's imaginations.
Yeah.
And we did a production run of about 200 minions last year.
Oh, fantastic.
And
brilliant.
You think a minion is kind of a relatively simple shape,
yeah,
but it's incredibly detailed and very, very difficult to make,
yeah,
and very difficult to actually work with the CGI file,
yes,
to create the part in the first place. And so while it looks fun and all the children like it, it's actually, as a technical challenge, exceptionally
difficult.
So,
yeah.
So what is the best thing you've ever seen 3D printed?
I don't really know, to be honest. Everything surprises you with 3D printing.
Because it's so intricate and detailed.
Yeah, yeah. And where it can go. There are various different ways of doing 3D printing that give you a different surface finish or a different strength of component. They've now got metal 3D printing, which is really interesting.
Yeah. That must be incredibly complex to print metal with metal as a...
Yeah, I don't fully understand how they do it. But
is it an alloy? They do it with
I've seen making a lot of titanium components.
With 3D printing?
Yeah, apparently NASA want to do it for rocket engine nozzles.
Right.
Because apparently they're enormous billets of titanium that they use.
Yeah.
Where they are machining out a massive lump out the middle. And they're doing so much machining, they can't guarantee the material properties throughout the whole shroud. So they're now 3D printing them where they can use much less material and they can guarantee the material properties that
it's the same all the way through.
All the way through.
That's incredible.
It is.
I think, we could talk for ages. Yeah. I think it's really interesting. However, we have a little section in the show, Jay, don't we?
We do, unboxing.
Unboxing, so...
Unboxing. But before we do unboxing, just could you tell us where people could find you? Website, Twitter...
Yes, our website is www.equinox3dengineering.co.uk.
Brilliant.
On Twitter, we're Equinox3D.
And you're going to hang around and stay with us for the rest of the show, is that right?
Yeah.
Great, that's really great. So, Jay, over to you.
Darren, as we've got you here, we have a slot in the show, which is unboxing. And what we'd like you to do, I have no idea what is in the box, but what we'd like is for you to unbox it for us.
So we've got our normal lovely purple box, and I'd say we're not sure what's in it.
So is this Christmas come early?
It is, hopefully.
And do I get to keep what's inside?
Unfortunately not, no, sorry.
Steve's running away with it afterwards.
Yeah, I think that could well be the case.
Right, what are your initial impressions of the box?
It fits in my hands.
Fits in your hand, yeah. It looks like it has like a black sleeve on the outside of the box, is that right?
Yes, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce the name on it.
So it's Suunto.
Suunto.
And I think it's a Spartan Ultra GPS watch.
Well, it's got a nice picture of a watch on the front.
Yeah, but this is not any normal watch, I think you'll find.
Ooh.
Not going by the... I've got a little bit of information about it, actually. And it's £483.55.
Okay, so that's why I'm not taking it home, is it?
Please do not drop it.
How much would you pay for it, do you think, just based on initial impressions?
I don't know. I don't think I'm that shocked by the price.
No, Cinto, a well-known make, especially around dive watches. Oh, right. I think they initially started making scuba diving-type watches. So that could be used for divers to regulate their time underwater and the depth that they've gone to. So there's quite a lot of computing power within a very small piece of equipment, actually.
Yeah.
So before we go into the details of the watch, in the box, I just thought I'd say what we kind of get in there. So there's a USB cable, which is not a micro USB, right, which apparently is quite useful when you're using water-resistant products.
Yep.
So this particular product, it is 100 meters water resistance, which is
quite
far.
Yeah.
And then also within the box, we also get a warranty guide, and a setup guide, and a Cinto sticker, I guess you can stick on your head if you want.
I don't know where you put that.
Yeah. but yeah. So initial impressions: is the watch heavy there, Darren?
Not particularly, and it looks very watch-like. If you know what I mean.
Put it on, by all means.
Sort of different. Mm. But this looks like a watch.
So it looks like, from the box, it's like a sports training sort of aid. Mm. And it will give you variety of information via the screen as to certain things that have gone on.
And just while Darren's setting that up, it'll be useful for the listeners to know that it has a battery life of up to 26 hours.
Which is amazing. I assume it's rechargeable.
Yes, yeah. with the USB cable.
Yep.
It also has it supports over 80 different sports.
Right.
I mean, that is a lot of sports.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's an Olympic watch.
Could you name 80 different sports? I'm not sure.
I definitely couldn't. It also has route navigation with heat maps, and it also it specializes in particular sports, so running, cycling, swimming, and adventure sports in particular, which is where it's really good for. So I believe that there's a middle button that switches the watch on there, Darren.
I'm pressing, but nothing's happening.
Nothing's turning on.
It's probably flat.
Probably flat.
It's flat out of the box.
Get that production team to charge it.
Honestly, you can't get the staff.
Well, so it's very nice, even though it's not on.
It looks great.
Yes.
I think we gathered that. It's got loads of functions. I mean, I personally use Strava on my phone rather than a watch, and that gives similar data. But the thing with the watch, I think, is that's different. It's got that Bluetooth connectivity. So if you want to do heart rate monitoring, for instance, then you would wear a monitor and that would automatically speak to the watch. So, is really good. So I suppose we're going to wrap this up in a sec.
Just a quick question, though.
Yes.
Would you? So we like to do a bit where we say, would you get out the box or would you say back in the box for it?
I quite like it, so I think I'd get it out of the box.
Get it out of the box.
But what about you, Jay? It turned on.
I think that I'd probably have to sell everything I own to buy it, which isn't
true.
Much. So I would say get out the box if I had the money.
I would say a definite yes.
Yes.
I think it looks fantastic as a watch. It's really chunky and visually looks quite appealing.
Definitely, yeah.
I think with the functionality, it's great. So
yeah.
I personally...
And for any listeners, if you are interested in the product, please go to www.cinto.co.uk and you can find out more information about it there.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a deal. The information I've got is the list price is actually a little bit more than the price I quoted. It's actually around the £510 mark. So, but a very nice product, and it's a yes from me, yes, as they say.
And thank you very much for unboxing it, Darren.
So, we're now going to go to a short interview with Paul Andrews, which was undertaken a few days ago. Paul's been involved in a variety of internet-based ventures, And he's going to talk a little bit about that and also the World Wide Web. So, without further ado, we'll go across and hear a little bit of the interview.
So I'm with Paul Andrews, who's a chief executive of Jobs in Kent. If you don't know about Jobs in Kent, it's a huge, huge website for recruitment, and there's lots of those around, but it was one of the first ones about. So I'm very interested to hear from Paul. First of all, we know it's the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web. But also, Paul, what was it like, literally, when you started off in recruitment? And the internet was a new thing. So how did it all start, and where did you get the idea from?
Yeah, it was very new. The internet was unheard of. It was the Wild West. And my background actually wasn't in recruitment. My background has always been in IT, but I was in business with my now ex-wife, and we had a recruitment business, but I was operating as a management consultant, working with technology businesses. And back in the late 1990s, the technology business was very... it was hugely high profile, and it was a massively big marketplace, and there was a shortage of skilled people in it. And we were trying to recruit technical people. And back in the day, we used the two main market newspapers, which was Computing and Computer Weekly.
So there were no jobs online? There was no such thing then?
There was no online.
And this is literally just 25 years ago. It's not very long ago at all.
Yeah. In fact, it wasn't even that long ago. It was only 20 years ago, really. The World Wide Web had only just started to happen. And those of us that were using it were using things like AOL or CompuServe, if you remember.
Yeah, no such thing as Google then, of course.
No, Google didn't exist. You know, Facebook didn't exist. Twitter didn't exist. There was no social media. And we used, just for what it's worth, we used a search engine called Dogpile.
I've never heard of that. Dogpile, no.
Dogpile was a meta search engine. Yeah. Back in the day, it really was the Wild West. Mark Andreessen had launched Netscape, and there were things like Alta Vista, Yahoo had just started, and they were just all search engines.
And there was like Ask Jeeves. I mean, I remember using Netscape as the browser, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then Microsoft caught on and decided to launch Internet Explorer. But back in those days, online was very, very poorly served. And we did all of our advertising in the press. So we used industry magazines or newspapers or the broadsheets like the Sunday Telegraph or the Sunday Times.
Expensive, presumably.
A page advert in the Sunday Times was £45,000.
And that was then?
And that was then, 20-odd years ago. But we used to pay it. There was no alternative. We were paying, as a small agency then, we were paying £300,000 a year in print advertising. And funny enough, one of our contractors, a software contractor, a guy called Robbie Cowling, rang us up one day and said, "Sorry, guys, I'm leaving. I'm starting a business." "What are you doing, Robbie?" He said, "I'm doing an email list for freelancers."
And presumably that's him emailing jobs out to say what jobs, so manually, presumably.
Basically, what it was, there was a thing at the time, there were two things that he kind of based it on as an idea. There was a thing called Kix, C-I-X, which was an American email list / forum. And it was a very, back in the day, they had things called bulletin boards. This is so archaic.
Actually, I remember those as well. That's just gone into my time frame, you know, my head. Yeah. Bulletin boards, yeah. Which literally were electronic sticky notes that you posted up on a board, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. But it was really archaic stuff, you know, incredibly slow, nothing like today's standards. And there was one called Kix, which was a place where IT techies posted stuff. And it was a combination of techie, geeky stuff and people going, "You haven't got a job, have you?" And at the same time, a thing called Craigslist started in the United States. And Craigslist was an advertising listing, most like Gumtree now. Oh, Craigslist still exists. It's still a huge website. But it was a text-based line-by-line advertiser.
Yeah.
And they started this kind of... email listing, which they called JobServe.
I was going to say, I remember recruiting for people and we used JobServe, and actually there didn't seem to be much alternative. And in those days, JobServe was cutting edge, I think.
It was the first. Yeah. JobServe was actually... Robbie started JobServe back in the late 90s, and it was the world's first recruitment portal. But he didn't start it as a portal. Mm. He started it as this email list for IT freelancers. And it was a cross between a bulletin board and a list. But very quickly, it evolved into a website, because parallel to the ideas, the World Wide Web itself was starting to take shape, and the concept of websites was starting to take shape. And some of the first websites that were available, I think the very first website that was put up was like 30 years ago, but it was slow after
that. Yeah, I mean, I worked in the university at the time, and we used to have a network called Super Janet. And in those days, it was very, very educational. And it was used more for research. It was more like a massive encyclopedia library. And only then did it start, as you say, people having web pages and thinking, oh, actually, I could do this commercially. I could tell somebody about myself. Whereas before, it was just used literally like a library, I would say.
Absolutely. And if you remember back in those days, though, even the websites themselves were nothing like a website that you have today. They were line-by-line editors. It was mostly just raw text. Mm. And if you spent a few days, you might be able to upload a picture to it.
It wasn't actually far off just raw HTML, actually, was it?
Yeah, exactly. it was just, it was really arcane stuff. Anyway, Robbie launched JobServe, which was the world's first recruitment portal. And loads of people looked at that and went, "Whoa, that's a good idea." And lots of people started piling into the market. And the first ones that started to come out were things like Monster, that was owned by the world's then largest recruitment agency, which is Manpower. And there was a company called Stepstone. And Stepstone put £50 million into the development of an online recruitment portal. And
which is hilarious, because now today you wouldn't spend more than, I don't know, 50 grand on a half decent website.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's bizarre.
They poured a huge amount of money into this, and Church International, which is a company that I was involved with at the time, we were an early adopter of advertising on JobServe. Mm. But then you've got to remember that the only people with real access to the internet were techies.
Or academics,
yeah, exactly, yeah. But they were certainly not the general public in a way. You're absolutely right. Or the military, ARPANET and things like that. Yeah. So the only people that really could get into the internet at all were techies. So for us, it suited us because it was techies we were after. So we started advertising on JobServe. And we cut our annual advertising bill from $300,000 to $13,000.
That's an incredible... I mean, people talk about disruption now, you know, models that are disruptive. That's a hugely disruptive model.
It was a hugely disruptive model. And I can tell you a couple of interesting things about that at the time as well. Not only did we cut vastly our spend, we increased the returns on that spend because we quadrupled the amount of people we got.
Double whammy.
Yeah, yeah, so it was really brilliant. The interesting thing, and I still cite this today because it took What's Names of Steel to do this. There were two trade newspapers at the time, Computing and Computer Weekly. Now, if you can...
They were huge publications.
They
were like hundreds of pages thick.
Yeah, absolutely. And each of those pages was worth 20,000 quid in advertising. Mm. And there were literally hundreds of pages in every edition of those two newspapers. And interestingly, the two publishers chose different routes to go.
So one of them was Haymarket, I think.
One of them was Haymarket, which was Computing.
Yeah.
And the other one was a Reed Elsevier, which was Computer Weekly.
Both huge companies.
Both huge companies. But the editorial teams, and I just have so much admiration for doing this, because it took a huge leap of faith to do this. Mm. Computing tried to ignore it and just carried on gradually reducing the prices of their advertising. Computer Weekly went, do you know what? This is the future. We're going to go online.
That's such a hard business decision, isn't it? Huge.
It is massive.
I mean, when you look at Kodak, for example, trying to ignore the fact that digital photography is around and is now dead as a doornail.
Exactly. Mm. And Computer Weekly went from earning truckloads of money. They developed CW Jobs and the price of the adverts plummeted and their revenues plummeted. But 20 years later, CW Jobs is the second biggest technical website for jobs, and computing doesn't exist as a paper at all.
So, your final comment on this, there's so much disruptive technology around.
Yeah.
There's lots of old business models that are struggling.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would you do now? I mean, obviously, it depends on the circumstances, but what would you do? You've got to go... You've got to have a board of directors who understand what's going on, don't they, in a much wider context, and have to make brave decisions.
Yeah, you do. I mean, you can also look at, just kind of to tell you how we got into the market with Jobs in Kent, though. Everybody was piling into the market, building these global portals and talking about globalisation and the global reach of the internet. But sometimes you have to be a bit more sensible than that as well. Because I looked at it and I just thought, but who changes jobs on a global basis?
Not many.
A very tiny proportion of very specialist people. 99% of people work within 10 miles of where they live, but there's no website catering for that. And StepStone, who blew 50 million, got that completely wrong.
Yeah.
They built a global job site. So if you went in and searched for a job as a bookkeeper, it would give you a job in Melbourne or a job in Buenos Aires. And yeah, really, I just want to work in Maidstone.
It's interesting for you. You've got to take bold decisions, but actually don't forget the local reach of the internet as well as the global reach.
Don't forget practicalities. Yeah. Don't forget the customers. Don't forget how people are going to use this service. Yes, you can disintermediate stuff. Yes, you can go global. But is global is your, where you need to be?
Is your sector global?
So
what you're saying is don't get carried away by the technology. Choose
exactly,
the right technology
exactly.
for your business.
It's a combination. It's absolutely a combination of using the technology in a clever way, but also satisfying a customer need or finding a niche within that customer need. Because clearly there is a global platform for recruitment, but there's also a regional one.
Which is much stronger.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's where Jobs in Kent came from, was that regional need. And, you know, it took 10 years before anybody caught up with us on that, by which time we had a massive lead. We grabbed a lot of the market share and we were ahead of everybody because nobody attacked that niche. They were still playing at this high level.
Because they got too excited.
Yeah, exactly.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much, Paul. Cheers.
Brilliant.
Well, welcome back, and we're going to talk now to Pete Lancaster. Pete's, I think, is the CEO and owner of Documobi. Welcome, Pete.
Good afternoon.
And thanks for joining us on the show. It's quite interesting to hear on that piece, actually, the pre-record we had with Paul, about the reach of services and products and how important understanding your customer is. And I know that that's the sort of field you work in as well, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Our raison d'etre is to help users, consumers, to interact with the world around them, particularly stuff that is printed or on TV.
Yeah.
So that's where we come from. It's the ability to take user-generated content and work with it and do more stuff with it.
How do we go about, though, because we are overwhelmed with information, aren't we?
We are indeed.
And how do you balance what the individual wants or maybe wants or needs and that you wish to push to them as such as well? How do we do that?
Okay, so our latest implementation is in fact all about the user. It's not about the brand at all.
Right.
Just to give you a little bit of background, there are currently 3.8 trillion photos that are printed.
Wow.
You've got on your mantelpiece, in shoeboxes and photo albums and the like. Some of those photos are over 100 years old. And as they say, you know, every picture tells a story.
Right.
Now, the thing about photos is printed photos, old ones, is that they can fade and disappear and everything else, but they are inherently static in their nature. So, yes, you have a visual image, but does it tell the whole story? And the answer is, well, actually, no.
No.
It's a momentary snapshot in time, and therefore, what we set about, what our US patent is all about, is the ability for a user to take their own stuff, their own photos, their own memories, and to embed in those other memories from other people who may have been there at the time, right, or who have a story to tell about that picture of Auntie Jean.
Yeah.
So, Pete, just before we go into more about what DocuMobi does, I'm quite interested in your background, because I know that you're an accomplished presenter. Would you be able to tell us a bit more about that?
Well, I'm from the graphics world, the print and graphics world, and my specialism was introducing new technologies.
Right.
So in the late 70s, when phototyping first came around, I was involved around Fleet Street, when phototype setting took over from hot metal.
And they were the good old days, right?
They were the halcyon days, actually. And from then, I worked in another new technology called digital imaging. So for the first time, you could airbrush using a computer. You could airbrush stuff out of a photo for a catalogue, for example, or merge photos electronically. It was all done chemically prior to then. So I then, for my sins, was one of the early users of the internet. I still remember before email was invented, you'd get me on 100544,1607.
I can't even imagine how hard life was back then.
Pace of life was a bit slower then. So as an early user of the internet, I was also then involved, after the digital imaging, with the world's first digital printing press that could print basically one copy, but thousands of individual copies of different things, all at high speed.
Yeah.
So I linked the world of the internet with the world of digital printing, so that you could go online and, for the first time, for example, at Leeds United, we had a greeting card that you could go online, use a little bit of software just in the browser, and customize one card so it was kind of from the captain of Leeds United to your son, for example.
Yes, yeah.
Wow. So that was the world's first
online merchandise. And how that's gone forward as well.
Merchandise.
Yeah.
And if you're not a Leeds United supporter...
No, I'm not, I have to say.
Me neither.
But, so from obviously those early involvements in digital print and digital media, and linking that into the internet, how did you move forward towards DocuMobi?
Okay, so prior to DocuMobi, what I did was I was an independent, and I'd go around the world, and companies like HP and Canon and Kodak and Xerox and people like that would employ me to go and try and teach the world of printing how to take their businesses online.
Yeah.
And in doing so, and this was back 2009, January 2009, at CES in Las Vegas, Microsoft launched something called Microsoft Tag. You may be aware of QR codes, those little black and white square things, which you can scan with your smartphone. Well, Microsoft came out with their own version, which was colored triangles instead of black squares.
Okay. That's taken off then.
Goodness, we can do better than this.
Yeah. So you've got... So you're embedding additional information within an image? Or
correct. With no need for QR codes or tags or NFC or anything. And it doesn't have to be before the image is printed. We could make the Egyptian hieroglyphics interactive.
And that takes you to additional web content? Is that how it actually works? Is that...
Yes, you can take it. A brand can use it to take you to further information based on who you are, where you are, what time you're scanning, because of all the metadata we collect from the phone itself.
Right.
So that can then drive conditional logic to say, so this is Steve, he's in Maidstone, it's 3:45, we know he likes strawberries, here's a special offer for the supermarket that's 230 yards away. Wow. And we're just about to go out of sell-by date.
Right.
So here's a 50% coupon.
But is that happening now, do you think?
No. It's,
it they, could.
It can.
Yeah.
And this is where brands are looking to go. And there are many, 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 many digital technologies out there that can do lots of lovely, lovely things.
Yes.
You may be aware of iBeacons.
No. Explain to me what they are.
They're little sensors that you can put in stores.
Right.
And they sense the location of your phone.
Right.
To within, half a metre or whatever.
So they know what route you take round the shop and what your shopping preferences are, I assume.
If you give it permission.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it can then say, OK, here's an offer for cornflakes. It's on two aisles down, and the offer's on for 30 minutes.
I mean, that's amazing. And I think, obviously, that a huge... It is about trying to give the consumer what they want, isn't it? Or maybe they don't want, but they... that's maybe part of it as well, yeah. I suppose.
Well, yeah. This is... You've really hit a button there. This is one of the key issues, I believe, in marketing right now. Many, many things are push technology. And push technology is trying to ram down your throat what they think you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now, the next generation, and this is where we come in, is the ability for users to interact with a brand at a totally different level.
Yeah. And in a level they'd like to see as well. Yeah, right. Personalized.
Yeah. 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 So this is where our technology comes in. And what we've done and we have two elements to the business. One is marketing services and the other is user-generated merchandise, if you will.
Yep.
At the moment, if you think about iBeacons, that only works when you're in store. If you think about QR codes or augmented reality on a tin of beans,
yep.
It doesn't know which brand or which retailer you're buying from. And it's all push, 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 push. But from a consumer perspective, if you want to interact with the products from the brand, be it consumer goods or hard goods or whatever else, then you've got an issue. You have many different technologies, access technologies, like QR codes, NFC, augmented reality. Then you've got television and you have radio, of course.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And none of these techs, there isn't a single technology that works with all of those instances of the brand, apart from DocuMobi, unique.
So, Pete, I've been looking at the DocuMobi website, and it says the DocuMobi API allows physical gift cards, print, packaging, and TV to be linked to digital content from inside a brand's app. Now, I'm quite naive here. I know that API stands for Application Program Interface, and that nearly every coder will be using an API. But please, could you explain to someone like me and listeners who are not that technical what an API actually is and why it's important?
Okay, so in the olden days, everything was hard-coded and baked, which means that, you know, you had to rewrite everything to accommodate one little piece of functionality.
Right.
It all had to work seamlessly. Basically, APIs are now taking over the world where it's a little code snippet, it's a tiny little piece of code that you can install into your system, and when you want to access that particular piece of functionality, the API allows you to seamlessly go out, do that bit of function, and then go back into the main system, if you will.
Right.
So it's a very lightweight, simple, efficient, effective way of integrating products.
So so you've got the consumer-based DocuMobi product as such, which is about enhancing images and experience and providing selected content yourself, really. Yep. And then you've got the other element, which is about companies using your process to enable additional content to be given to the consumer. Is that a fair?
That's pretty correct. Yeah, there is some overlap, but primarily, yes, DocuMobi Fuse as a technology allows brands to use our API to make all of their packaging, their press ads, their TV commercials, whatever it might be, digitally interactive. So using the brand app, you can go click on the TV commercial or click on the packaging or click on the advert and be taken to a personalized experience.
And you see that happening more and more, wouldn't we, with products? People want more. I mean, we've just had an unboxing where we looked at a watch. People want to feel it, touch it, or at least see it operating, understand the product better. Is that right?
Absolutely. You know, in this day and age, we're all self-serve. You know, I bet you before you go into a shop and buy anything, you'll check it out online first.
Absolutely.
Now, of course, a lot of the millennials don't even have computers anymore.
No.
Yeah, everything's on their phone.
Tablets, so they can do it anywhere. So you can go into a store now, look at a product and say, right, show me who's got vouchers for this product.
Yeah, yeah.
And coupons, yeah. You know, so you can do lots of things. And so from a marketing perspective, we're a kind of deep level enabler to allow brands to have a better, closer, more meaningful interaction with their consumers across every visual touch point of their brand. And in the consumer side, we talk about gift cards and greeting cards, for example.
Yes.
Well, now the gift card in America is absolutely colossal. You know, there's 2 billion gift cards.
Really?
Every year in America.
And there's a more and more personalized service available, I suppose.
Mm. Well, what we do in a gift card, the biggest objection to giving somebody a gift card is that it's deemed to be quite impersonal.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
You haven't really put much thought in it. So what we allow users to do is to embed a video into a generically printed gift card,
right,
that only the intended recipient can see.
Okay, so that by using their smartphone or tablet or other device, it will take them to that video content, is that right?
Correct. So yep. This is me buying you a gift card and saying, hey, I remember you were saying you wanted to get into cycling, so here's a yep. Alfred's gift card. Hope you enjoy.
Yeah.
And you can, in return, can then thank me with a video.
Oh, fantastic.
That's cool.
Yeah.
On a more broader sense, do you think that there's still a role for advertising within print?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, actually, there's a lot of very current research that print is actually having a resurgence.
Right.
And ironically, particularly with millennials, like JCPenney's in America ditched their printed catalogue a few years ago. They've just resurrected it.
Right, that's interesting.
So don't write print off at all. Okay, there is some print that should never have been printed anyway, all the spam stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to die.
And the celebrity magazines and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than flicking through the Screwfix catalogue, I can tell you.
That's what you get up to, is it?
Is that right, Pete?
Well, the thing now, of course, is maybe do you remember when you used to book a holiday? You'd get a holiday brochure.
Oh,
and
I used
you'd
to
get
love
like
looking at the pictures.
2.5 square inches of detail, and on that you might spend £2,000.
Yeah, or more. Yes,
or more.
This was pre
so now,
my
course,
birth. I think I don't remember
with
this.
Your smartphone, see videos, walk around it, get reviews.
Yeah,
and so on and so on.
Yeah, no, so. I mean it's valuable content. We are coming to the end, and we're running out of time on the show. Obviously, you've. Like Darren, you've been a businessman yourself for a while. What do you think the hardest lesson? I'm going to come to Darren first. What do you think the hardest lesson or the hardest thing about running your own business is, and a tech business in that?
There's lots of things. Lots of
really?
Things I've found really difficult.
Yeah.
I thought it would all be about an idea and
yeah.
just taking it and running it.
Yeah.
But the skills that you've got to learn
yeah.
and the sort of lack of support, if you like, unless you go looking for it,
yeah,
makes things really difficult.
And Pete, is that the same for you? Have you got the same experience?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is only just the beginning.
Yes.
Then all of the business rules, it doesn't matter what the technology or product or service or anything, matters not one jot. 85% of it is running this business, and cash is king.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. that's the other thing. I think from my personal experience as well, it's cash flow is a critical issue for any young business as well. Is that the same for you, Darren?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You think that you're selling it for a profit and that's all you need to do.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to it than
so
that.
So does that go to prove that accountants run the world?
I'd like to think not.
So before we go, Pete, could you just tell us how people can get in touch with DocuMobi?
Sure, yeah. Our website is documobi.com.
Brilliant.
Email me at peter@documobi.com. I'd be happy to take any calls.
No, and thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you both.
It's been really great. So we're going to say goodbye to Pete now, and we'll just finish off on the show. So thank you, Pete.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you for joining us. Bye. We're coming to the end of the show. It's been great, Darren, to have you along, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's been lovely.
I really can't wait to see some of the funfair stuff that you've done and everything else. It's great. But also, it's been really good to talk about Formula One and motorsport and the technology that exists there. So thank you for joining us. It's been great.
And so before we go, just if any listeners have any feedback for us or want to get in touch with us, please do tweet us at the Tech Talk Show UK. Or alternatively, you can visit us on our website, www.thetechtalkshow.co.uk. We'd love to get your feedback, and we'd love to hear if you have any questions or if you have anything interesting to tell us about the world of tech, just let us know.
And thanks for joining us. We'll hopefully see you on the next show.
Thanks, Steve.
Cheers.